We have come to the last stanza, as it were, in this song of Jehovah's suffering servant, verses 10 to 12, and they are the verses of great satisfaction, of a sense of completion, of vindication, of almost God sighing and resting in the things that we have looked at. Let's begin in chapter 52, verse 13, because as we end this morning, we come full circle back to "Behold my servant." So let's read all the way through this song of Jehovah's suffering servant. "Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Many were astonished at thee. His visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations. The kings shall shut their mouths at him, for that which had not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard shall they consider. Who hath believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. But surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken and smitten of God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, and the chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. And for the transgression of my people was he stricken. And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was there any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied. And by his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death. He was numbered with transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and he made intercession for the transgressors." What a difficult phrase this last portion opens with, in a sense. "Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise," or literally to crush him. It pleased the Lord to crush him. And I am always amazed as I look at these things, as I'm sure any of you that are parents have to be amazed and think, you know, of a parent who loves his child more than us have ever loved any of our children. And yet it says here that it was the good pleasure of the Father. It pleased the Father to crush his Son. There was something divine, you know, involved. He wasn't just a martyr. His death would have accomplished nothing. It wasn't an accident or a victim of Roman or Jewish hands. He was, as it tells us in Revelation chapter 13, the Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. He was the Lamb that was slain before anything was made, from the foundation of the world. In fact, all of creation only set the stage for this divine romance, as it were, to take place, for God to take a bride out of human history for his Son. And knowing all that would come, the Lamb was slain from the foundation of the world. And so we come to this text in Isaiah that says, "And it pleased Jehovah to crush him, that he hath put him to grief." That's our word for sickness and affliction that we have earlier. That he put him to grief and made his soul an offering for sin. That he was sickened by the weight, the crushing weight of the sin of humanity that came upon him there as he was on the cross. Not just the offering of his physical frame, but his soul itself, his very life, an offering, a trespass offering. And the crushing weight of that, that none of us can imagine, the sin in thought and in deed. Sin and its effect on creation and sickness and disease. Sin from every past generation, from the present. Sin flowing like a river from unborn generations, from every age, coming upon this trespass offering, the precious Son of God, bearing up under the weight of that, the crushing, sickening weight of it, and somehow the pleasure of the Father. It pleased the Lord to crush him. Because that Lamb had been slain before the foundation of the world. He was the Lamb of God that would take away the sin of the world. And the Father knew, the Son knew, for the glory that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. Something was being accomplished. It was no accident. He was no mere martyr. The divine hand was here, crushing him, allowing him to be crushed by the predeterminate counsel and foreknowledge of God, that he gave his life a ransom, a trespass offering for many, and that this act was at the center of time and human history. That when God created the worlds, through the days of creation, behold, it was good, it was very good, all of that for man, all of that for Adam, not for himself, you know, the fruit-bearing trees after their kind. God said, behold, it was very good. He's saying, wait till Adam bites into a Georgia peach. It will blow his mind. Wait until this happens. And all of that to bring mankind and set him on the stage, knowing all the while that sin would enter, that man would fall, and the unimaginable consequences of that in every age, in brutality, in war, in sin, in sickness, disease, what it would unleash in God's creation and on mankind. But the one had come who would take away the sin of the world. And in that, it pleased the Father to crush him. Knowing what was at stake, and knowing that he would see his seed, knowing that he would prolong his days, knowing that the pleasure of the Lord would prosper in his hand. It takes us in these verses to the satisfaction on the part of God. It takes us past the grave, you know, to the empty tomb, to the resurrection. It takes us now to tell us of the life and the conquest of this one who had died. Everyone else, when they die, their life story brings us to the point of their death and tells us all they had accomplished. This one who God is describing for us had been brutalized, had yielded himself to these things, and his conquests are held before us after his death. Because clearly what God is putting before us is the fact that he would be crushed under the weight of our sin. He would lay on him the iniquity of us all, that God's stroke would fall on him because of our transgressions, and that he would make his soul literally a trespass offering, that there was somewhere where humankind had stepped across the line, and because humankind had stepped across the line and sinned against God, there was a debt that was incurred, and that debt was eternal. When you sin against someone, when you wrong someone, who that person is determines the depth of the debt that is incurred. When humankind sins against an eternal and holy God, the debt that must be paid is eternal and divine. And there was only one that could pay that. And it pleased the Father to crush him under the weight of our afflictions and trespasses, and to make his soul, not just his physical frame, an offering for sin. And scholars want to argue, well, is it God that made his soul an offering for sin, or does it say he offered his soul an offering for sin? Well, the answer to that is yes. Of course. We're told that he was offered by the eternal Spirit. Jesus said, no man takes my life. I lay it down. I take it up again. And it tells us God so loved the world that he gave his son. The Trinity offered him. He was crushed under the hand of God. It was a divine act. And they were all involved, Father, Son, and Spirit. And he yielded his soul an offering for sin, it says. And he shall see his seed. There will be offspring from this. He shall prolong his days past 33 and a half earthly years on into eternity. The pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. What an amazing word to be attached to all of this. He shall be satisfied. The satisfaction of Almighty God. It was his good pleasure to crush his son under the weight of our sin, because he knew that he would bear it as a trespass offering, and that beyond the cross and the tomb, that his son would see his seed, his offspring, born out of his action, born of faith, that he would prolong his days. He's the one without beginning and without end. And that the pleasure of the Lord would prosper in his hand. The pleasure of the Lord, what is it that would prosper? What is it that gave them satisfaction? The pleasure of the Lord. It tells us in Revelation chapter 4 that you and I are created for his pleasure, for his goodwill. That's all you exist for. You ain't here for you. We spent a lifetime realizing that, even as Christians. We're here for his pleasure. That's why we breathe. It says our next breath is in his hand. Well, that almost seems demeaning. We're here for his pleasure. What is he, an egomaniac? That's why we're here. We're here for his pleasure. No. Look, the question hangs on what is his pleasure. And as we watch him in the Garden of Eden, we watch him find satisfaction. It's on the seventh day. He goes through the days of creation. And it says on the seventh day he rested. And it tells us in Isaiah, he didn't rest because he was weary. He didn't rest because he put in over 40 hours. He didn't rest because he has a 6-day work week. He rested in his satisfaction. Everything he had made was good. And he rested in his fellowship with Adam. The first full day of rest was the first full days of Adam's existence, and they stood face to face in Eden in the cool of the day in fellowship. Adam able to step into the presence of God. And God rested and he was satisfied. It was his pleasure. Of all that he made, there's almost a sigh at the end of the 6 day as he says, now, everything's in place. Let us make man in our image and in our likeness. and he gave him dominion over all that he had made. And he sat with Adam in the cool of the day. That was his pleasure. All things are and were created for his pleasure. Your life brings God pleasure when he is in open fellowship with you. When he tries to describe to us his love, it is through the terms of him being the bridegroom and the church being the bride. It's through the context of he's our father and we're his children. Or he'll talk about the shepherd and the sheep. He tries to put it in a context that we understand. We hear much about the fact that our lives are to glorify God. Well, they should. But that's not the purpose. Or that our lives are to serve him. Well, we should. That's not the purpose. I have a bride. I didn't marry her to glorify me. She should. It isn't that I come home from work and she goes, "Oh, honey. Didn't have her to serve me. Takes us a while to learn that, doesn't it, husbands? It was for the pleasure of intimacy, the intimacy of love, the fellowship, being one. Children. He's our father, we're his children. I have children. I didn't have them to glorify me. It wasn't like we had one and I came home and said, "Honey, you know, at the end of a long day, I love this, I praise you, daddy stuff. Let's have a bunch of them. You know, we'll set them up all over the living room and I'll walk into the, they'll all be around me." And if you have children, you know, you didn't have them to serve you. His pleasure, the pleasure of Yahweh, will be fulfilled by his hand, will prosper to completion. What was it to restore what was lost in Eden? That you and I, with open face, may come back into fellowship with a holy God. That's the pleasure of the Lord that prospered in his hand. And there's such satisfaction here. It's almost as though God, looking at the Old Testament, you know, just said, "I have to lift this before you." You know, Israel was failing. The Assyrian army had gone through. God was gracious and destroyed the Assyrians, but Jerusalem and Judah still didn't turn back, and he knew that Babylon was going to carry them away. And there was all of this struggle in the Old Testament. It's almost as though Jehovah says, "But wait, let me lift. Here is the answer. Here is the solution. Here is the solution from the ages before the world was formed, from the foundation of the world. Let me hold before you the one who will put all of this to rest. And my pleasure will prosper in his hands." Remarkable picture held before us. "He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied." It seems the Son, no soul ever travailed like his soul had travailed. "He shall be satisfied." The satisfaction of the Father, pleased to crush him. The pleasure of the Lord prospering in his hand. The satisfaction of the Son, to tetelestai, paid in full, it is finished. The pleasure of the Father, redemption. Isaiah is telling us that this is the trespass offering that every offering, every sacrifice in the Old Testament looked forward to. Because he saw us forgiven. He saw Calvary Chapel. He saw us sitting here today. It was his pleasure to call us his own, to give his Son under the crushing weight of our sin so that we might be his sons and daughters. And Jesus himself would see the travail of his soul for the glory that was set before him. He endured this cross, despising the shame. He would be satisfied. It's interesting in John's gospel to find him at the feast of winter, it tells us, and the Feast of Lights, Hanukkah, walking in Solomon's portico alone. And I see him there musing, walking there, knowing that within a few months he would have been crucified, risen, ascended, and that Peter would preach a sermon and 3,000 people in one day in Solomon's portico would come to faith. He would see his seed, the travail of his soul. And I wonder, as he was musing there in Solomon's portico in winter, what was before his eyes, his heart. He shall be satisfied. There's great satisfaction in this. And by his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many. Is it by what he knew he would do this? Well, he knew. Or is it by the knowledge of him? Well, it's both. For me, by the knowledge of him shall my righteous servant justify many. By coming to know Christ, he will justify literally the definite article many. We would say the masses will be justified through the knowledge of Christ, coming to saving faith. By the knowledge of him shall my righteous servant justify the masses, for he shall bear their iniquities. Now, something interesting is happening here as we come to the end of verse 11 and we enter into verse 12. As we've gone through the prophecy, who hath believed our report? To whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? Surely he hath borne our griefs, carried our sorrows. He was wounded for our transgressions. Isaiah is speaking on behalf of the nation, on behalf of believers of every age. Isaiah is speaking, but somehow as we come to the end of verse 11, Jehovah begins to speak again, and he says, by the knowledge of who he is shall my righteous servant. And he takes us all the way back then to where we began in chapter 52, verse 13, where it says, behold, my servant shall deal prudently. We come back to the ecce homo, behold, my righteous servant. Much different reason than Pilate could have ever said it. Behold the man. Behold, God speaking again. My righteous servant. By the knowledge of my righteous servant shall the masses be justified, because he shall bear their iniquity. The pleasure of the Lord, the satisfaction of heaven. Behold, my righteous servant. Verse 12, therefore will I, Jehovah again speaking, divide him a portion with the strong. He shall divide the spoil with the strong. And just, therefore, Jehovah said, I'm going to divide him a portion with the great. He's pointing to the conquest of kings, like human history has rolled by. Roman legions and Babylonian armies and Nebuchadnezzar, the kings of the earth had taken their spoil. He said, no, I'm going to appoint him the portion of the great. He's the one who will take the real spoils of what all of this has ever been about. And he will divide to himself. Then it says, he shall divide the spoil with the strong, and he will carve up the earth the way he wants to. He will rule with a rod of iron, with a divine scepter. There's such a satisfaction here on the part of God. What's been accomplished? What's been done? He's given himself to it. It was my pleasure, my goodwill to crush him, not ever to see him wince in pain, not some sick overwatching of a body or a soul writhing in agony. But it was my pleasure to see the sin of the world and the consequences of it born and put away once and for all, and to see what the law could never accomplish, accomplished in my son. And the pleasure of all of that prospered in his hand, and he has seen the travail of his soul and is satisfied. And by the knowledge of my righteous servant, the masses will be justified because he will bear their iniquity. And I'm the one who's going to divide the spoil of the great, not the kings of the earth. And he'll divide the spoil of the strong. It will be his. Here we are. Paul says and prays that we might realize what are the riches of his inheritance in the saints. Not the riches of our inheritance and glory. We can read Revelation 21 and 22. We can think about heaven and look at some of those things. But beyond that, Paul says, you know, I wish that you would all understand in regards to the hope of our calling, what are the riches of his inheritance in us? That God considers himself wealthy because of something he has in us, because of Christ's accomplished work. What he could never accomplish by the law, the greatest law, love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbors yourself, he could never command us to do that. If he could just command us to do that, there had been no cross. There'd be no need for a Savior. He'd have just commanded us to live righteously, and we've done it. Imagine how easy it'd be to raise kids. You just behave for the rest of your life. That's a commandment. Oh, okay. You tell them one time, take the trash out. I never want to tell you again. No problem. Keep your room clean. Never want to say that again. Oh, it's a command. I understand. You'll never have to say that again. But we're responders. And we love him because he first loved us. And why is it that we've followed? Why is it that we are in this train of multitudes through the ages that have given their hearts to Christ? Why is it that he's been able to accomplish in us what the law could never accomplish? It tells us. There's a because. Because, and each and repeats the because he hath poured out his soul unto death. Because he was numbered with transgressors, because he bare the sin of the masses, of the many, because he made intercession for transgressors. How is it that God finally took hold of the hearts of his people and accomplished what the law could never accomplish? He said, behold, consider my servant. Look at him. Look at Jesus. He's going to accomplish what he sent forth to do. Be extolled. Be lifted up. Be high. He's going to be so brutalized in the process that not even a human semblance will be attached to his frame by the time they're done with him. And yet, kings. He's going to divide the spoil of the great. Kings shall shut their mouths at him. But I want you to look, because who has believed our report? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He's going to grow up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of dry ground, be unexpected. There's anything, if we look at him, he doesn't look different than another human being. It would never have been the plan that a human being would have made up. They'd have had a conqueror come through the sky, but he didn't come to overthrow Rome. He came to overthrow sin and death. Surely he hath borne our sorrows, he hath carried our griefs, we have seen him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, every man to his own way. But God has laid upon him the iniquity of us all. And God takes us through, look at this, behold this. In all of that agony and suffering, it pleased me to crush him under the weight of your iniquity and to make his soul a trespass offering. And he has seen his seed, the multitudes gathered into the family of God, prolonged his days. And the pleasure of my heart has prospered in his hand. He himself seen the travail of his soul. And is satisfied. And by the knowledge of my righteous servant, the masses are justified because he bears their iniquity. And because of that, he's the one who is the only true great king. And I've divided the spoil of it all, of the ages, to him. and he's carved up the spoil of the strong. This servant and the hearts of mankind will flow after him. Why? Not because they were commanded, but because he hath poured out his soul unto death. We love him because he first loved us. Because he was numbered with the transgressors, he came and he died in our place. Because he bare the sin of many. And the last phrase beautifully is in the perfect. It says, and because he makes intercession for transgressors. Because he is alive right now at the right hand of the Father, where he ever liveth and maketh intercession for the saints. Not only has he accomplished all of that for us, right now our names are upon his lips at the right hand of power and authority. He still upholds us in our journey. He maketh intercession for transgressors. That's who you're married to, you know, a transgressor. My wife's a little luckier than most of your wives, but that's who your children are. Spurgeon said, I'm not what I should be, but I'm not what I used to be, and I'm not what I'm going to be. And he is in the process of conforming us into the image of his Son. His Son has done it all. Poured out his soul for you and I unto death. Numbered with the transgressors. He bare the sin vicariously. Satisfied heaven. And is now at the right hand of the Father, where he makes intercession. Lifting us up today in our struggles and our journey. Till his completed work is finally realized in its full, justified, sanctified, and glorified.